Welcome to Listen to Older Voices, a program produced for Uniting Melba and podcast through the Toorak Times. It's always a pleasure to bring you, through their stories, the life and times of older people in our community. All very interesting, all very different, and all very entertaining. This is a special Baby Boomers edition. Hi, Rob Greaves here, and it's a pleasure to be bringing you part two of the three-part story of baby boomer Christine Easdown. In part one, we learned that Christine decided to follow a career as a teacher. While studying, she visits Southeast Asia, and while having some rather close encounters with a rather unfriendly Pathet Lao, the trip certainly kicks in a desire to travel. So it is, in part three, we feature both stories about her teaching experiences, the first of which in Chris's own words was a shocker, as well as her trips overseas. We learn how she goes from being a teacher to a super cook on a bus tour through North Africa, and she shares some amazing stories of her adventures. On returning to Australia, she returns to teaching secondary school students, and while she's in fact a good teacher, we learn why she decides to take a sabbatical and heads overseas. Her decision to leave is traced back to a strong spiritual experience she had whilst visiting Israel, during a time where she was feeling she had a spiritual vacuum. So it is she eventually heads to India, where she works in a Delhi crisis centre for travellers. However, she does return to Australia to fulfil her obligations to the education department before she's off again, and this time to Kathmandu. We pick up with Chris talking about why she changed universities during her early student days. First of all, Chris, thank you very much for inviting me into your home. And could I start by asking you, when were you born and whereabouts were you born?
Yeah, sure, Rob. I was born on the 7th of April 1955 at St Andrew's Hospital in East Melbourne, which later became the original Peter McCallum Hospital.
Well, you're really very much a local girl in terms of born and bred in Melbourne.
Absolutely.
What would be your earliest memories then?
My earliest memory is when I was at Sunday school. And I was in the nursery department, so I would have been maybe three, maybe four. And when we were in Sunday school in nursery, it was really a lot of play, a little bit of interruption for a Bible story and some songs. And I was riding on the rocking horse. So even as a very little tacker, I loved horses. And I had to get off the rocking horse to go and sing Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. And I was most put out because after Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star, someone else got the rocking horse.
Oh, no wonder you were put out. You mentioned you were born in East Melbourne. Mum and Dad, what sort of person was your mum?
Well, my mum was one of four children, the second of four children. She'd been born in Bendigo, and when she was three, they moved from Bendigo to Brighton, and the family did it reasonably hard during the Depression. So Mum was born in 1917, so I actually had older parents than a lot of my friends. Mm. So Mum did it hard. My grandfather lost his job during the Depression because he had a heart attack. And when he rang his boss 2 weeks after the heart attack to say, I'm ready to come back to work, he was advised that he didn't have a job anymore. It had been given to someone else.
Oh.
So fortunately, there had been a family inheritance which had been hidden under the floorboard somewhere in the house, which kept the family going during the Depression.
Sure.
Mum was a pretty bright girl, but I think also a very shy girl. And so she was always a bit of a nervous, reclusive sort of person in some ways, yet she had an extraordinary sense of community. So, involved with school canteen and doing stuff at the church and on a couple of social groups through the church. But she got a scholarship to go to McRobb Girls High, and she did her year 11, what would have been year 11, leaving certificate at McRobb. Mm-hmm. And then after that, she put herself through night school to become an accountant.
Right.
So Mum was a very mathematical, very logical, very straight thinker. And she struggled with the changes that were happening in society during the 60s and 70s when I was a kid. And she hadn't, yeah, she didn't sort of understand why people would want to go out socially to the dance or that sort of thing.
That age gap again.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think too, though, you know, both my parents had grown up in the church, and so we went to church until we were sort of 16, 17, and then once we finished high school, we were kind of given the choice. But religion and faith were very important
strong to
Mum.
Mm. What about Dad? What sort of person was he?
Dad was a really interesting bloke. And, again, family, bit of family history. My great-grandmother, my paternal great-grandmother, was a single parent, but she had a child out of wedlock. Mm-hmm. And so my grandfather was orphaned when he was about eight, went into foster care. It wasn't a good placement, as I understand, and he ran away at the age of 10.
Wow.
Because he'd had a bit of a beating for going fishing with his mate.
Wow.
And he got himself up to Warrigal, and the publican took him in for a night and offered him accommodation and lodgings, and this little boy decided that he would be his own man and look after himself from now. And so he lived in the logging camps and did a lot of work around the Strzelecki Ranges.
So he really did look after himself.
He did look after himself. In a lovely little memoir that he wrote, he talked about being in the big forest fire that happened in the 1890s. It burnt for about 6 months through West Gippsland, and he was at Allumbee. And he described all the brave pioneering men and women of West Gippsland being huddled in this clearing in the forest with the massive tall trees of the forest being completely circled
Wow.
by fire. So Granddad got himself up to Melbourne at some point, trained as a carpenter. So he had a skill and a trade, which mm-hmm. was good, but then his family, that family suffered during the Depression
sure.
and during the war because Granddad lost his house. And
yeah.
so Dad ended up having to leave school at the age of 13, and he was apprenticed to a grocer. He had a stutter. So one of the jobs that he found worst of all jobs in being an apprentice grocer was he had to go and cold call people around Brighton and to get their custom.
Oh, goodness me, how stressful.
Yes, it was. And this was coming up to the Depression. So,
yeah.
And he was the breadwinner for the family.
So he had to do
so
it.
So he had to do it. So he went on from there and worked in the grocery trade. He was also very interesting in that when the war came along, he was a conscientious objector. He would not be trained to kill anyone. But he felt that he still wanted to support Australia in its effort
mm-hmm.
in the war. So he signed up on condition that he would never have to hold a gun. And from there he worked initially as a quartermaster, so using his skills from grocery and stock management and so on. He used those skills as a quartermaster in a field hospital unit.
Mm-hmm.
But he had a bit of a run-in with his sergeant, and they worked out pretty quickly that this wasn't going to work in the long term, and an opportunity came up for him to work with he ended up working as a welfare officer to the troops.
Oh.
So he ended up in both at Alamein in Egypt and on the Kokoda Trail as the welfare officer who was providing entertainment and recreation for the troops. So on the troop ships, on the track. One of the funny stories is that they were donated a gramophone when they were doing jungle training in Townsville. He carried a gramophone up the Kokoda track so that they could have music.
That's bordering on bizarre in some ways. That's really strange.
It is, but there's also a lovely story about Charlie's coffee joint, which was on the beach at the start of the Kokoda track, where he had a little fire and a drum of boiling water, and he made cups of tea and coffee for the troops as they were going up and down. So Dad also had this really lovely sort of sense of community and service. And You know, without the benefit of education, he continued to work in grocery, small business. He owned small businesses. But then when he was coming up to retirement, he heard about an organisation called the Early Planning for Retirement Association. He joined and became the first president and stayed president for 20 years of the Bentley chapter.
Wow.
And ran very successful groups on armchair travel and music appreciation. So he educated himself about music, loved classical music, and ran these very successful groups. So they were both quite interesting people, very different.
Although they had that, you mentioned your mum had that community sort of spirit connection, so they did have that very much in common.
Yes, and mum also loved classical music.
Uh-huh.
So she was firmly bedded in the music of the past.
Yes.
And whereas dad was actually a bit more open-minded about music, so I often used to get him to tape music for me and he would sit and listen and he'd come back and he'd say, "Found that Indian music interesting. Some of it was okay, but I really didn't like Laurie Anderson."
Well, he'd probably have a few people out there agreeing with him.
Absolutely.
She is an acquired taste.
She is.
And this is Listen to Older Voices, Ageless Stories on Ageless Radio. I'm Rob Greaves and I'm talking with Chris Easdown, and Chris is recollecting her life, particularly with her father. What about you in school? You obviously went to school. What was your primary school experience like?
It was a bit of a mixed bag. I was inspired by my grade 3 teacher. I remember sitting on the gatepost in tears during the summer holidays between grade 2 and 3 because I was going into Miss Murray's grade. And she was an elderly woman. She'd been teaching forever. And she sometimes had a bit of a sternness about her. And I was a bit worried because my grade 2 teacher hadn't been a great friend either. But it turned out Miss Murray was absolutely wonderful and she inspired me to become a teacher. So from grade 3, I set my goal on becoming a primary school teacher. I mean, I was quite a good student, you know, did quite well academically. I was absolutely mortified when I failed a spelling test in grade 6. But probably the sporting highlight of my primary school teacher was being a member of the under 13 crossball team, which won the local competition and ended up at the state championships. And
Right. We
could break the state record when we were on fire and we came second in the state. So that was my great sporting achievement of my school life.
It's more than many of us have.
And, yeah, high school was, I went to the local high school, Bentley High School,
mm-hmm.
and so I had most of my friends and was, you know, pretty happy there. But my father bought a milk bar in McKinnon. And for 6 months I rode my bike from McKinnon to Bentley, which took about 45 minutes. And there wasn't money for me to take a train and a bus. So I changed to McKinnon High. And that was an interesting experience. Like I really felt the disruption of my friendships. I changed schools in year 9. So I was like 14. Mm. I came into established friendships within the school. And while I did make friends at the school, I often just still felt a bit of an outsider.
A very vulnerable age group, isn't it? Girls at 14. So that would have been, very upsetting in some ways.
Yeah, it was. And that was kind of coupled with, like, the disruption of moving into a milk bar. You know, in those days it was a 365-day-a-year proposition. Yeah. The shops had milk licences, so the shop had to open on Good Friday and Christmas Day.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, whenever we would sit down to have dinner as a family, the buzzer would go on the front door. And so we never sat down and ate a meal together.
Mm-hmm.
It put a lot of stress on the family in all sorts of ways.
Were you expected to work in the milk bar?
Yep. Yeah, we worked. So I started working in the milk bar when I was like 13 and a half. I did the shop on Saturday afternoons initially. My brother did Saturday morning. My younger brother did the bottles he maintained the storeroom with the bottles, and in those days everything was recycled. Mm. So, you know, he had to store the empties near the back and bring the stock forward to and into the shop. So we all had different jobs in there. Look, I look back on that and I think it was such a good experience in so many ways, because I was a bit of a shy kid, and I had to learn to speak and deal with the public, had to work with all sorts of people. Mm. You know, some customers who we didn't particularly like, but some very interesting customers. And you know, by the time we sold the shop, we could send Mum and Dad out for the day so they could have some time off, and my brother and I would run the shop and close up at night. And so I suppose I built up a lot of communication skills and confidence through that time.
Did it affect your social life at all? Did it restrict it, or were you still able to have an active one?
I still had a social life, so it completely... Initially, I tried to keep my friends from my original high school, and I remember going to a couple of teenage parties and thinking I was terribly grown up doing that. You know, there were adults on the other part of the party, and so we were kind of having our little party on the side. But it certainly broke up some of my long-term friendships with kids in the neighbourhood where I grew up. But I joined up with three other girls who lived close to me, and they'd actually had some real benefits for my social life. So when during Form 3, going into Form 4, they used to go to Opus, the dance at St Kilda Town Hall, and I was beside myself with envy. But my mum and dad said I had to wait until I was 15 before I was allowed to go to Opus. So I had to wait till I was 15 and 1 month, because they went to Opus about 2 days before my birthday, my 15th birthday.
Dear,
and mum and dad were very strict about that. So, you know, we went to Opus as long as that ran. We saw some great bands there. At Moomba, we would go into Moomba, watch the procession, go to the big concert that used to be at the Music Bowl. I saw Blackfeather, one of my favourite bands of the time.
Because that period was Melbourne or Australia-wide was very active music scene, wasn't it? I mean,
it was,
you were there for some of the best groups in some ways.
We saw some fantastic things, some fantastic bands. And you know, these were just playing at little town hall gigs.
Mm.
So, you know, like Billy Thorpe and the Aztecs, I mean, I didn't stay inside for Billy Thorpe. I had to listen to him from the street because he was a bit too loud for me. But yeah, it was a great time, and so yeah, we kind of did that sort of thing right through till the end of Form 6, and then the group kind of split up. You know, I ended up going to Monash Uni, another friend went to Frankston Teachers College, someone else went to Secretarial College. So we still socialised a bit together, but then started to move off into new groups.
So you go to Melbourne Uni.
Monash Uni.
Monash Uni.
Yeah.
What course did you do?
Did a Bachelor of Arts. I had actually gone to uni with the great goal, great dream of becoming a linguist and working in the diplomatic corps. So I'd studied French all the way through high school, and I picked up Indonesian at uni. And I realised pretty quickly that my French and language skills would never be good enough to get me to where I thought I would like to go.
Right.
But I had a great time with language. Like at the end of my second year at uni, I travelled over to Southeast Asia with one of my old school friends, and we travelled through Thailand and Laos. We had a very exciting time in Laos.
Roughly what years were these?
That was during the summer of 73, 74.
Oh, that was, there was still a lot of activity going on in that part of the world, wasn't there?
Oh, yes. Yes, in Laos we had a couple of encounters with the Pathet Lao. So they were the guerrilla army that ended up overthrowing the monarchy in Laos.
So when you say you had some encounters, can you enlarge on that a little?
Yeah. When we were in Vientiane, we were walking through, we walked through the Arc de Triomphe. They had their own replica Arc de Triomphe.
Oh, right.
Yeah, apparently Laos had been donated some concrete that was going to build a runway, but they needed a French Arc de Triomphe. And down the road from there was a large compound, and someone had told us that was where the Pathet Lao headquarters was. And I went to take a photo, and they threw stones at us.
You never found out why? No.
I guess it was just a bit uncool to be photographing the guerrilla army.
Oh, okay.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Anyway, I realised that I should put my camera away. But the next time was actually a bit of stupidity and just seeing what I could get away with. So we were in Luang Prabang, which is was the royal capital, and on the banks of the Mekong, right up in the mountains, was a summer palace, the king's summer palace. And while we were in Luang Prabang, we had met a young monk, Buddhist monk, who had some language skills, English skills, and he wanted to practice his English. So he took us into the monastery. We had, you know, tea and cakes with the novice monks. So one day he took us for a walk up the hill, and overlooking, at the top of the hill overlooking the royal palace, was a little bunker with two soldiers in it. And it was quite a view, nice view, with the palace down there in the valley and the Mekong and the jungle all around it. And I just lined up my camera to take a photo, but just made sure that I had it on the angle that I could see the soldiers on the side of the frame.
Yeah.
And they knew what I was up to and they pointed a gun at me.
Oh, you got the message quickly?
I did. Yep. There are no photos of the Pathet Lao in my photos.
What a shame, though. That would have made a great photo.
Yes.
Yeah.
And this is Listen to Older Voices, a program that presents the stories of everyday Australians through the recollection of their lives.
And then the next bit of excitement was the day that we flew from Luang Prabang to another village higher up in the mountains where the Mekong is a much smaller river called Ban Hue Sai. And this was the last government outpost. There was a military base. And so we jumped on a speedboat. We had two speedboats booked for our charter group to take about a, I don't know, 1.5-2 hour trip up the river and cross into Thailand. The motor on one of the speedboats broke down.
Oh.
So they rafted the two boats together and we chugged very slowly up the river. It took a very long time and we were all a bit disgruntled because there was no food, there was no water, and we were hungry and thirsty. But when we were in Thailand, a day or two later, we heard that Ban Hue Sai was attacked by the Pathet Lao and fell to the...
Gee, so you got out just at the right time.
So we left just in time.
Yeah.
But, it was a bit of a galling time, and sort of I think one of those times where I just sat back and thought, you have no idea what is going to happen in your life, and, you know, you're in a world... And you don't know, you think you know what's going on, but you actually know very, very little of what's
happening. Would have been aware that there was political upheaval before you went, but that didn't affect your decision to go there.
No, I'd spoken to someone who had actually done the same trip with the Australian Union of Students a year or two before me, and he had said that there had been a group of French students who'd been killed. But I just thought, this will be all right, you know. It'll be okay. I'll be okay.
Oh, the foolishness of youth.
Absolutely. But it was a great adventure.
Of course it was.
And I think it was a great privilege to spend time in that country before it closed for 30 years. You know, and it was lovely because in some ways it prepared me for what happened in the mid-80s when I went and lived and worked in Kathmandu.
Which we will get to in due course. So you completed your course at Monash?
Yep, finished a Bachelor of Arts. I changed direction and became a geographer.
That's a massive change of direction, isn't it?
Well, geography was going to be my minor subject. So in second year, I did, I'd been accepted into honours stream in geography and in French as well.
Right.
But I decided after the end of second year that I'd let the languages go, and I did a double major in geography. But by the end of third year, I was just kind of losing direction, and I wasn't sure, so sure that I wanted to be a school teacher anymore.
Right.
I'd started to see that there were a lot more opportunities out there in the world for a girl than just being a teacher. But I didn't have the confidence to cancel, get out of my teaching studentship, which had been like a, you know, the scholarship that had paid for the trips overseas that I'd done, and you know, pretty comfortable life. I'd bought a car and that sort of thing with what I saved.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but aren't you committed once you undertake those to work for a while, or you have to pay the whole thing back?
That's right. You were committed to 3-year teaching, and you know, Mum and Dad, you know, emphasised the importance of this was a contract that I'd made.
Mm.
And that I should honour that contract. And they said, well, if you don't like teaching after 3 years, you can go and do something else or think about it then. And, like, I knew people who had, you know, given up their teaching studentship and, you know, who ended up doing the payback scheme. I didn't have the confidence in myself to do that, and I had no idea. I don't know that I even had the confidence in myself to go and get the jobs that I was thinking, oh, I could maybe go and do that.
Join Chris and I next week for the second part of a program where we learn that she became a teacher, and her early experiences were, in her words, a shocker. Her story also takes us to India, where she finds herself working and having a spiritual experience in Israel. That's next week, part two of The Life and Times of Christine Easdown on Listen to Older Voices. Listen to Older Voices is produced by Rob Greaves at the Melbourne Community Support Program on behalf of Uniting Victoria Tasmania. The program is funded from the Commonwealth and State Government's Home and Community Care Program and is brought to you through the Toorak Times.